You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We're continuing our history series in the history of Puritanism and the Puritan movement with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Thanks to Concordia University, Wisconsin for supporting The Coffee Hour. Find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
Joining us today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Thank you, Sarah and Andy. I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
In our study of the Puritan movement last week, we were just approaching the Scottish Rebellion. I think that's where we left off. Where do you want to pick up with the Scottish Rebellion this week?
Well, I do want to start there with just a reminder of two things. First, a basic thing about this period, which I've repeated, but I'm not sure I've always demonstrated very well, but that politics and religion are very much mixed. And religious issues are political issues, and political issues are religious issues. That's one thing. Second thing, and I don't think we've mentioned this in quite a while, but the King of England was also the King of Scotland. And even though today we talk about a united kingdom, there was no united kingdom until the 18th century. These are two separate kingdoms, two separate churches, two separate judicial systems, two separate everything except a king. They share a king. So King Charles, like his father, King James, wanted to try to bring his two kingdoms together. And one of the ways in which he thought they could come together would be if they would start worshiping together. And that doesn't mean people coming together, but worshiping the same way. After all, from the perspective of the monarch, James and Charles, both churches were Protestant churches belonging to the Reformed Communion. And so it seemed just kind of natural that they should be worshiping more alike than they were. Now, of course, with this kind of ignoring or treating as trivial is the fact that the Scottish Reformation had produced a Presbyterian church and a much more plain kind of worship in the churches reflected more of continental Protestantism than of Anglican Book of Common Prayer. But nonetheless, Charles, along with the help of Laud, thought this was possible. And Charles ordered bishops of Scotland. And this is going to get confusing. Presbyterian churches don't have bishops. Well, James had brought bishops back in, and for about 20 years, there was kind of debate in Scotland whether they're going to be fully Presbyterian or whether they'd be stuck with bishops. Well, that got ended in the 1590s. But nonetheless, there are still some bishops in the Church of Scotland. And so Charles, working through those bishops, helped by Laud, prepared a Book of Common Prayer for the Church of Scotland. And this Book of Common Prayer included lots of stuff that had made the Puritans in England angry. We talked about some of these things in earlier episodes. Making the sign of the cross in baptism, that was in the Scottish book. Kneeling for communion, that was in the Scottish book. There's lots of real present language about the Lord's Supper that wasn't even in the English book, but that is now in the Scottish book. And, I should say there were some concessions. There weren't any vestments prescribed. It said you'd use the ones that were prescribed or shall be by Parliament. They didn't call the minister a priest anymore. They called him a presbyter. They didn't have any Bible reading from the Apocrypha. But nonetheless, it was a lot different from what they were used to. And from their perspective, and this is the important point, it seemed a whole lot more Roman Catholic than their old way of worshiping. So it's July of 1637. The new book is supposed to be used for the first time in Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, in St. Giles Cathedral. Well, the new book provoked a riot. One gal flew through her stool at the preacher, and another yelled out, the mass is entered among us. People were throwing Bibles. They were yelling Pope at the officiant. It was just a madhouse. That riot became a rebellion because all over Scotland, not only the clergy, but the gentry and nobles as well, took the position that this book was an imposition, that it violated not only their church procedures, but also the law of the land, and accordingly needed to be rejected. Thousands of people flocked to sign a document drawn up by the opponents called the National Covenant. And this National Covenant pledged to the Scots to defend their system of worship. No liturgy would ever be accepted into their churches without the approval by Parliament and the General Assembly of the Scottish Church. It was kind of National Presbyterian Church Assembly. Well, Charles is the king, and they are rebelling against his orders. So he sees this as an act of rebellion and decided to use force to enforce conformity in Scotland. He mustered an English army from the northern provinces, found a general to lead them into battle. But when they got onto the scene and saw the Scots arrayed against them, they realized they were no match for the Scottish soldiers. By this point, or at this point in history, the Scots had had a lot of practice fighting as mercenaries in the 30 Years' War and elsewhere. So they had an international reputation against these poorly armed, just recently mustered soldiers from the north of England. So instead of there being a battle, Charles agreed to a truce. But what were the conditions of the truce? Well, it was really kind of a delay in answering the fundamental question about what was going to happen with that prayer book. The Scottish Parliament met, and they weren't vague at all on what they wanted, and that was not only no book, but the abolition of the bishops that had been imposed upon them earlier. Charles, in a hard place, what's he going to do? Is he going to just let this continue and these rebels get away with their defiance? Or is he going to take further action? Well, if he was going to take further action, he really needed a better army. And that meant better supplies, better training, better recruits in the first place. And that meant money. He needed money. One of his closest advisors, a fellow by the name of Thomas Wentford, said, it's okay to call Parliament for this reason. The English really hate the Scots the way the Scots hate the English, and for sure they will vote for that money for putting down a rebellion of the Scots. So don't worry about calling Parliament again. It'll be okay. So that's what Charles did. He summoned a Parliament. That meant elections for commons, and then the lords of the realm as well, coming to Westminster for April of 1640. Turned out that Wentworth's advice was all wrong. The leaders of the Parliament, especially the House of Commons, were so upset with all the things that had gone on during those 11 years and all the kind of ridiculous ways in which Charles had been trying to get money without a parliament, that they would not act on anything until Charles had responded to and corrected all of their grievances. Well, after just 3 weeks, Charles had realized what a big mistake this was, and so he sent them home. They hadn't voted any money, but they also had none of their grievances addressed and solved. They were sent home. And of course, this really infuriated Charles's parliamentary opponents even more, that he wouldn't even deal with the things that bothered them so greatly. What's going to happen? Well, he's still got the Scots. And so he says, he's going to have to fight them again. And this time he tries to generate more money. He got the church official to vote him money, and they did. He also, the church officials in England, now this is in a a representative meeting of the church also took steps to legislate for the church against the Puritans. All the clergy were supposed to preach on the divine right of kings four times a year. They were also supposed to take an oath to follow the prayer book. Politically, it was a big mistake to combine this with ending the short parliament and then also opposing these new regulations by Laud over against the Puritan movement just inflames the political opposition all the more. But he did get some money out of them. He's really desperate for money in these years. And at one point, he even started negotiating with Spain to see if they would kind of rent British shipping in order to get themselves over to the Netherlands to fight in the 30 Years' War. So it's a very bad situation for the king. He doesn't have any money. He wants to fight this war. He finally gets a little. He sends an army into the field. This time they actually fight, and they lose. The Scots beat the English decisively, and their troops move down into England and occupy northern England, the Shire of Northumberland, and also Durham County. So they're there in England, and they inform the king that they're not going home until he agrees with their position regarding the prayer book and the bishops, and also pays their expenses for having to stay put in northern England while they wait for the king to pay them. So, yeah. By the fall of 1640, Charles has placed himself into a desperate situation. And now, really, he has only one recourse, and that is to call Parliament again. So this time, they meet in November of 1640. And this is, you know, just about 6 months after he had sent them home, the short Parliament. Now, this particular Parliament does not officially go out of business. Listen to this. It does not officially go out of business until March of 1660, almost 20 years later. So if we called that first one the short Parliament, what do you think historians call this one?
The long Parliament.
The long Parliament. And that's what it is. The long Parliament. And this time, the leaders of Parliament know what they have to do, and that is they have to bargain with the king before he gets even a dime of help for the Scottish Rebellion. So maybe that's a good place to pause.
Yeah.
And then move forward from this.
Perfect. Yeah. We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason. To use your God-given gifts to help others. To live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world. To live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about the Scottish Rebellion and all of the ensuing parliaments and non-parliaments and
long parliaments
and very short ones and all of the controversy happening between England and Scotland during this time of Charles I. So we left off with the long Parliament and needing to bargain with the king. What happens at this point?
I should mention, I'll just give you one name. The leader of the House of Commons is a fellow by the name of John Pym. He's a lawyer from London, and he is a very zealous Puritan, but he's also really upset with the way the king has tried to rule without Parliament. So as he said to his fellow Puritan parliamentary leaders, they, the king, must be of another temper than they were the last parliament. They must not only sweep the house clean below, but must pull down all the cobwebs which hung in the top and corner. So that was going to be his agenda. They were really going to clean house. Now, to do that, well, they're going to bargain tough with the king. If the king wants any money at all, he is going to have to address their grievances. And their grievances include things like personnel. So the king's top political advisor, who had advised them in the first, the king to call a parliament, but from the standpoint of the parliament, was symptomatic of the abuses that the king was practicing in his rule, he was impeached and sent to the Tower of London. But that was also the fate of William Laud, the Archbishop of Canterbury. He's impeached and sent to the Tower of London. Now, I won't go into the details of impeachment, but impeachment is not the trial. It's something that the House of Commons could do on their own, and they did. So those two guys, keystones of the king's constitutional and ecclesiastical policies, are going to spend the next couple of years in the Tower of London. But what about the other matter? Well, if king wanted money to deal with the Scots, he was going to have to clean up the government from the standpoint of the House of Commons. And that meant abolishing all the extraordinary ways in which he had raised money without parliament representation, abolishing those prerogative courts that he had used to crack down on the bishops and the laymen. And then he was going to have to consider a reorganization of the church. There were bills actually introduced to abolish the bishops, and likewise bills introduced to put the personnel of the government to be appointed not only by the king, but by the parliament. So it takes time for all of these things to start working their way through. But one by one, Charles gives up on the things that he had been doing during those 11 years. At one point, Pym and his colleagues decide to pass a document, which is kind of a list of the abuses and their recommendations for taking care of these abuses forever. It's a document called the Grand Remonstrance. It's voted on in the late fall of 1641, and sometimes it's been compared to our own Declaration of Independence. You know how the Declaration of Independence says all of those things, the king has done this, the king has done this, the king has done this. Well, that's what the Grand Remonstrance is. The king has done this, the king has done this, the king has done this. But unlike our Declaration of Independence, which presents these things as violations of the natural rights that every human being has from God as creator, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, the Grand Remonstrance identifies all of these things as the result of a conspiracy in government. Well, what conspiracy in government do they find? Well, it was the Catholics, and particularly the Jesuits, who had the ear of the king and were implementing all of these things in church and state with the Puritans, which John Pym and the Puritan leaders thought so terrible. Now, I'm pointing that out so that we don't lose sight of the fact that this anti-Catholicism, the very strong motivator in the 17th century on the Puritan Protestant side. See, a lot of this stuff is really kind of the papacy and Catholicism, the Jesuits lurking behind the scenes and trying to win England back for the Catholic faith. So the Grand Remonstrance was passed narrowly, but it was passed. And a few months after that, Charles decided that he was going to have to take some action in order to stop. Oh yeah, I should have mentioned this. The Grand Remonstrance's solution to the problem would be that they'd get rid of the bishops, they'd refer all questions of church reform to a committee of clergy vetted by them, and that the king would have to submit all his candidates for royal ministers to the commons for their approval. In other words, the king would no longer have charge over his own personnel. So it was a radical solution, likewise, and a step forward even beyond the correction of the abuses that the Grand Remonstrance contained. And it passed narrowly, but it did pass. And it was at this point that Charles came to the conclusion that he was no longer going to be able to do anything with the Parliament. He couldn't send them home because one of the laws that he had agreed to was that they would not be dissolved without their own consent. That's why they lasted 20 years. The Long Parliament would not be dissolved without their own consent. So Charles decided things had to change. In January of 1642, he brought a company of troops down to Westminster, where Commons met, and stormed into their proceeding, 500 soldiers. He went to the front where the Speaker of the House was presiding, and he said, "By your leave, Mr. Speaker, I must borrow your chair." So he stood on the Speaker's chair and looked around for the leaders of the House of Commons, because he had come down there to arrest them, Pym and four others. They weren't there. They had been tipped off that he was coming, and they had gotten on a boat and sailed down the Thames to the city of London, which was a hotbed of parliamentary support and of Puritanism. Charles demanded of the Speaker where they had gone, but the Speaker fell to his knees and answered, "May it please your Majesty, I have neither eyes to see nor tongue to speak in this place, but as the House is pleased to direct me." Doesn't have much to do with religion, but it has a lot to do with representative government. He would not answer the king unless the House told him to do so. Charles put on a brave face. "Well," he said, "since I see that all the birds are flown, I do expect from you that you shall send them to me as soon as they return hither." But of course, they didn't. They did return, and Charles left. Charles went to Oxford, and a few months later, he announced to the country that Parliament was in a state of rebellion, and he called upon all good, loyal Englishmen to rally to his flag and to take up arms in order to correct things in Westminster. In other words, civil war, war between the king and his Parliament. So let me pause there and see if you guys have any question.
We have about a minute left. Anything you'd like to cover in the last minute?
Okay. Yes, that we will not fight the war in our next session, but we will actually talk about what they decided to do. Make a long story short, Parliament wins the war. And so that means that the parliamentary will have to decide what they want to do about religion. They're going to call a great big assembly known as the Westminster Assembly, and they will discover, if they hadn't known it before, they will discover that the Puritan wing of the Church of England was not united. There are lots of different ideas about what kind of Christianity they ought to have once they've replaced the king and the Church of England. So that's what's coming next.
Looking forward to it next week. Our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.